China. Okay, I heard at one end of the table there, Sam, China emerging as a major power. I heard Richard saying maybe they're past their peak. I'm also interested in, from a political sense, as to how Australia and China connect. So can we explore China a little bit? Richard, maybe you'd just like to start.
Yeah, my comment about past their peak was the rate of growth, not the the rise and rise of China. I would concur with the comments that Sam alluded to. I think the rise and rise of China, and it's not just the industrialisation either of either China or India or Greater Asia, it's also the unprecedented rate of urbanisation. You can go back through the annals of not just economic history but human history, and we have never before seen such a vast majority or number of people being taken from rural, semi-rural, provincial environments and placed in urban environments. And that is creating real pressures, real tensions, obviously city tensions, mega-city tensions, resource use tensions, and will continue to produce those tensions. My job in forecasting electricity demand is pretty simple these days in terms of this urbanisation process. The demand for electricity, when you have such a rapid rate of urbanisation, is exponential, basically. So China and India do not face what I would regard a traditional crisis in terms of petroleum energy. They face crises in terms of the generation and distribution of electricity so as to underpin and support this very rapid and unprecedented rate of urbanisation. So I think that is going to result in further tensions coming to being brought to bear. The other issue in terms of the rise and rise of China, I think from my perspective, and where I spend a lot of time, is probably the little understood tensions and relationship now between Japan and China, and the implications of what I think the Koizumi administration left us with in Japan, and that is a very much more fervent nationalistic bent in terms of politicians, particularly the young LDP politicians coming through. We're also seeing that being played out in South Korea as well, particularly with the issue of North Korea. So we have a generation now of politicians coming through in the wake of Koizumi in Japan who are very much more nationalistic and very much wanting to engage in terms of tensions with China, and dare I say it, I think some of them probably, if scratched enough, probably have or would concur with the belief that they want to contain China in terms of its rise and rise and its regional power base.
Just a couple of points. This is not a criticism, Sam, but what Sam was saying was really beyond the narrow confines of the outlook for A7 in terms of an assessment of China and Asia more generally. I say that just in the context of what Richard was saying, that and both in his comments and his presentation, that it seems to me that China is not going to change in the sense that we've been talking about in 07 in any way that's going to impact on either negatively or even more positively, quote unquote, causing a boom, further rising commodity prices in 07. And therefore, it's not going to be, partly because of that, but also because of the broader political issues, the ramifications, the relationship with Japan, the United States and so on, is not going to be a player in the political environment narrowly in Australia in 07. China is not going to be an issue in this campaign going forward, in the year going forward. So the issues that Sam are raising, he's probably going to expand on it, are really looking beyond 07 into a broader construct about the shifting in geopolitical power.
Indeed, I wasn't trying to suggest that the balance of power view of the world is necessarily all going to come to some sort of head in 2007, or that it would have a direct bearing on Australia, except in one particular sense. If Iraq is going to be an issue in our election, what Howard has to, I think, pray for in a way is that he doesn't end up like Billy McMahon. You may recall Nixon and Kissinger went off to China and didn't bother to tell their trusted and faithful ally in Vietnam. Prime Minister McMahon was made to look silly. He had been warned that the United States, after the Nixon Doctrine had already been articulated, that the United States wasn't going to stay in Vietnam forever, and it wasn't going to forever not want to deal with China. Now, there's never an exact parallel. But for all of the anti-Iranian talk that's now going on, it wouldn't be impossible to imagine that for its own reasons, The United States wants to come to some accommodation with Iran. As a result of that, there is some kind of Baker-Hamilton approach which eases the situation in Iraq in return for the announcement of a stage withdrawal, etc., etc. Howard's nightmare must be not to have a situation where his close and trusted ally, George Bush, literally pulls the rug out from under him. Now, if the timing is good, that won't happen until late in 2007, after the elections or early in 2008. But I do think the clock is ticking. So I mentioned that as an aside in terms of balance of power, politics having an impact on Australia. And my only other comment about China is Beijing Olympics 2008. Immensely important to China. There's probably no single event for the last, who knows, 20 years, maybe even longer. This is China's coming out on the world stage in a way which, of course, wants to touch all the bases. The problem for China is that internally things ain't so calm, and they're going to have a very, very careful monitoring watch on the centres of discontent within China so it doesn't blow up in their faces as the Olympic Games are coming along in 2008. That's an issue for China internally, but it could have a spill-out effect externally.
I have to challenge Terry at least. When you were speaking of industrial relations not being an issue which you see of having great gravity as we head towards the next election, I think you're doing that more on the basis of traction with the populace rather than what is economically true or not true. I'd like to ask you to answer the question again, any other panellists, on whether you think that industrial relations and the differences between the two parties actually amounts to a hill of beans or not for business.
Thank you, Brian. Interesting question. It clearly there is I think the starting point, there is a significant difference in terms of the industrial relations policies of the two parties, and partly it's been inherited from the Beazley overhang. Just to make a slight digression, it seems that Julia Gillard's had to embark on a similar sort of retracement that Peter Garrett has done in terms of environmental policy, that she's, whether willingly or under the umbrella of projecting a greater reasonableness about destabilising what is there now. You've seen some retraction from the hard line that we saw through A6, that they're going to tear up the AWAs and the entire new structure. So I think the starting point might be a significant difference, but both in terms of the reality of dealing with the existing situation. I mean, take the GST is probably to some extent a useful example, but also maybe misleading because there are different dynamics. But the GST by 2001 was barely an issue, and certainly wasn't an issue. And any suggestion that you would backtrack by 2004 was not the case. I think that as we go through 2007, there'll be a lot of noise and thunder around the IR, but it won't be one that really threatens a fundamental choice by the time you get to the poll. I mean, the differences will be at the margin, and I think you have to also factor into that perspective what the government would propose to do, and I don't see the government proposing another round of dramatic reform. So the essentially you'll be, the choice will be the status quo or some fiddling at the margin. Yeah, maybe Richard.
Yeah, I would concur with that, and I would say the other thing is that, of course, we have a leader in Kevin Rudd who said he wants the small and medium business vote. So therefore, I think that probably explains a lot of what Terry was alluding to with Gillard the other night with hockey, where Julia Gillard said that she doesn't doubt that most of the advances will be made at enterprise bargaining level in Australia, so there is no challenge to that. And certainly if Rudd does want to actually draw out that small, medium, independent contractor vote, there cannot be any fundamental or substantial change. My suspicion is that the fiddling at the margins will probably be in terms of unfair dismissals, and it'll be that definition of a small company at 100 employees that may be brought down to maybe 50, even 25. But really that's a finessing, to be honest, at the margins. You're going to see Gillard continuing, I think, to play a fairly straight bat, to use a cricketing analogy, in terms of debate with hockey, wanting to make sure that the electorate, and particularly that important small, medium business, independent contractor constituency, is quite clear that there isn't any proposal to drop a grenade into the bunker in terms of workplace relations reforms.
Could I not so much make a comment but ask my fellow panellists, particularly Terry, three-part question. It's about demographics and a new generation of voters. Terry, in your analysis, you left out what I would call the Whitlamite factor, it's time. I mean, just, you know, a younger leadership, a younger sort of generation of Labour leadership, and the fact that Howard has been there now going for his fifth election, and it's uncertain whether he'll even stay for the full term. So, I mean, you might say this is fluffy and it doesn't really shift votes, but I'm just interested. Do you think it is an issue? But on industrial relations, what if out there amongst people, and you hear this in talkback, and again, it might be just fluff, there does seem to be a concern that even if they themselves aren't affected, that there seem to be people who are worried that their children coming into the workforce are not going to have the protection in awards and in conditions and in the way they're treated in the workplace that they had. Now, I think Beazley, interestingly enough, did tap into some of this concern. Are you saying it's going to just go away? There won't be enough difference between the parties? Don't you think it's a vote shifter amongst people when they go into the booth? I don't want my kids to have to face that sort of workplace. Or is that just so marginal it won't count?
No, I think what you say is absolutely true, Sam, that there is this, on both issues. I mean, the it's time thing has a certain potency. But it's in terms of whether the opposition will put all its eggs in that basket and present a winding back of what's there, which would address those concerns, or at the end of the day, through the year and when you get into the campaign, offering no substantive change which would actually meet those concerns. So I don't think they're going to ride that. I mean, you have to make a strategic decision, and I think the strategic decision is not to go down that path. And it fits into the broader characterisation, which they've obviously decided, and it's also fits place to the personality that Kevin Rudd is projecting as a different sort of John Howard. Stability, middle of the road, that you can have confidence in, both in terms of comparison with Mark Latham, most dramatically, but also Kim Beazley. So that the policy framework is not, the policy projection is not going to be to articulate difference. It's going to be, and that's also, I think, why it mutes to some extent, the it's time theme, that it's time purely on the basis that John has been there for 10 years, not because it's time because we offer a fresher, newer, dramatically different alternative. And I'm not sure about the demographics in terms of the age range of voters that... I haven't seen any recent research, but the idea that a younger Kevin Rudd and a younger, fresher team perhaps might appeal to younger voters and people that are coming in at 18, I don't think that's necessarily borne out in the research, but I haven't seen any recent research.
I would have thought the intergenerational voter angst is just probably much more potent for the opposition on education and training, to be honest. Yeah. You know, voters can go into the booths than they could have gone in for the last three elections and know that their kids actually have to provide for their own retirement income, which is very different to when they retired or when they potentially retire. And so that uncertainty is out there. I mean, there's also, of course, on health and pharmaceutical benefits, there's intergenerational angst that comes through there. But I think I actually think Rudd and the opposition are on a winner with education and training. As an issue potentially of intergenerational angst for voters out there, particularly and tied into the broader issues of the rise of China and India and this competition for global resources and competition in labour markets, the issue that we have got an economy where we've been up against the frontiers in terms of skill shortages and the like, and that these won't simply be overcome with policies of skilled immigration because we're competing against a lot of other countries out there for, you know, the world as the engineers and the like. So I would think that, for my mind, the issue of intergenerational voter angst be tipping would be education and training.
Thank you. Any other questions from the floor?
Yes, Michael Donchuk. I've got a question about your comments, Richard, with regards to surplus liquidity. I think you mentioned earlier on that the global surplus is quite significant and projected to be that way for some time. Given that we've had a lot of consumer borrowing, I suppose, in countries like Australia and the US and so on, that have driven large parts of our economies for a few years, do you see this situation getting worse? The surpluses ultimately ending up in banks' balance sheets and then being lent perhaps on even easier terms than what we've seen today?
Yeah, it's a good point. And when you look at the, Mike, when you look at where the surpluses are coming from too, because the other question I get asked is, well, you know, you've had major central banks actually raising interest rates and trying to wind back liquidity, and it's still telling us there's this growth in liquidity globally. Where it's coming from is, as I say, I spent a lot of time in the Gulf states now. It's coming out of the Gulf states, the oil-producing states, the petrodollars. I mean, they're registering liquidity growth at 20-30% per annum. It's coming out, as Sam said, out of Russia. Okay, and Putin, as the new energies are, is and the great irony there, of course, is that the August 1998 emerging markets debt crisis was precipitated by Russia. The irony is that they haven't got any debt left now to precipitate a emerging markets debt crisis. They are actually increasingly a net provider of savings. So those savings are coming into the system. At the moment, the United States is the biggest consumer of those excess global savings. 65% of daily capital flows is being consumed by the United States. Australia, of course, is a net consumer. However, in Australia's case, the other interesting situation that's occurring, of course, is internally with the rise of superannuation savings and the coming online of the Future Fund, okay, which on my own calculations is probably going to come online with close to $55 billion in its kick when it starts investing. So you've got $1 trillion of Australian superannuation savings increasingly looking for investments. So I think we're going to find in Australia a very interesting byplay, if you like, between the imperative to export more of these superannuation savings to find the investment opportunities on the one hand and the financing of consumption on the other. It is a case in point, though, as you say, that a lot of it has already found itself onto banks' balance sheets. But the other case in point for Australia, of course, and it is something when you look across the financial sector, is that Australian banks, by and large, are housing banks. And people get concerned in the United States about the concentration of housing mortgage risk in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. But when you look at regional banks in Australia, 85 to 90% of their asset base is the mortgage book, basically. So I think we need to look at that as well as we go forward of just how exposed banks are and opportunities for diversification of their business. And some banks are already doing that geographically. So I think it's a good point you raise. I think some of it will find its way under balance sheets, but I think we've also got this other byplay going on in terms of the increasing need to actually export superannuation retirement savings. That sets up some very interesting issues in terms of the two-way flow of capital in and out of Australia and the implications for the exchange rate, for example.
Bill McCarg from Colliers. We've talked about a lot of effects today, and one issue hasn't been specifically mentioned, which I think is possibly the greatest issue we're confronted with, but it hasn't been specifically mentioned in its own terms, and that is overpopulation of the planet. We hear about climate change. We know that the demand for water will double in the next 20 years. We've all heard about peak oil. And, of course, these are effects of the first-time overpopulation of the planet at some 6 billion now. We see the exponential growth of our population going forward, but the actual cause of these subsidiary problems hasn't actually been mentioned by any one of you. Do you understand or do you agree with me that the overarching problem of all of these issues is really the fact of the world is creaking under too much human population? Why hasn't this overpopulation issue been mentioned, or don't you think that is an issue?
I'm not a Malthusian. I'm not even a neo-Malthusian. I don't share your concern. I don't think people are the problem. I think that, I'm not an expert in trying to, understand whether the projections of population growth are as dramatic as the people who would share your view say they are. I'm inclined to be sceptical about it. What I do, I think, understand is that population growth is not something that happens right across the board. It is selective. I mean, China's got a different sort of demographic problem. It's trying to deal with its population growth. As Asia becomes more prosperous, I think they're going to focus their attention on their population growth. As you know, there are projections that countries in Europe are going in the opposite direction. I mean, there are predictions that by the middle of the century, we're not talking here, you know, 200 years from now, but 30 or 40 years from now, there'll be hardly any Italians, hardly any Dutch, hardly any Belgians, unless, of course, there are demographic shifts from Africa or from the Middle East into Western Europe. So it's not a universal concern right across the globe. There will be some areas where I think population will be an issue, some where there won't be, but I don't take the doomsday view that you do. Maybe I'm just an inherent optimist. We can cope, is what I'm saying.
Well, the starting point, I think, in any sort of assessment about overpopulation is that we've got 6.5 billion people on the planet now, and never have more people lived happier, more prosperous, healthier lives than in the past. So that we've gone from 5 billion to 6.5, we've gone from 4 to 5, and every time we've added a billion, more people have lived longer lives. And the suggestion that sort of denies the, and I know you can't take a particular point in time, we might be building a disaster which might be manifested when we get to 7 billion, but to this point in time, population increases coexisted with improving human prosperity and health and general well-being. Having said that, if you accept the extreme perspective of a Tim Flannery and so on, the solution is first to close all the coal-fired power stations and just about all the other sources of energy in the world that generate 80% of the energy, and then we need to reduce the population to a billion, rather quickly. I don't know that there are too many people who are going to be volunteering for that queue.
I think that's right, and I think as Sam alluded to, from my perspective, I think the real imperative basically is the integration of populations when we're dealing with ageing populations you're talking about. China actually has an ageing population, by the way, and it actually has a terrible term I hate, but we have to use it when we're dealing with the African continent. It has corrosives in there in terms of that as well, with HIV and gender imbalance and the like that's is inherent in that population. So I think in terms of growth of the two rising adolescents, India is the one that still has population growth there. That is, in my view, an issue that will be overcome with greater education in the population and living standards and the like. I think it's fraught with danger when you try and impose population policies in India, as the Gandhi family will tell you. So I don't think I'd be advocating that. But I think, more importantly, it's really the integration of populations and people movement around the world, which is going to be much more important and much more critical in the next 10 to 20 years. We talked about Iran, where I'm probably one of the few people in this room who has two visas in my passport for Iran. So I've been there and I've dealt with the mullahs, and they're a difficult bunch. But what I can tell you also about Iran that scares the, challenges me, put it that way, is that 70% of the population is under the age of 30. I was in Saudi Arabia 2 weeks ago, about 65% of the population is under the age of 30, and the majority are males, poorly educated. So I think that's our challenge of how we deal with that, how we deal with areas of the world where we have cultural issues, religious issues and the like, where they are showing the inverse in terms of demographic spread and distribution to the Western cultures and economies. And at the end of the day, if we keep ageing at the rate we're ageing at and our fertility rates remain where they are, we are going to need those younger, productive people coming in to support our economy, our growth and our prosperity.